BDNG podcast. My name is Tina McKenzie and I am the Education Development Lead for the BDNG. I hope you enjoy listening to the BDNG podcast and find them beneficial to your practice. These podcasts are sponsored by Amaril. Amaril has no influence over the content of these podcasts. Happy listening! Hello everybody and welcome to another episode of BDNG Meets Podcast. My name is Tina McKenzie and I'm the Education and Development Lead for the BDNG. So today I have great pleasure of introducing Dr. Christopher Sargent, who is based down in Brighton and he's the Medical Director of Pathway. He's also Secretary for the Faculty for Homeless and Inclusion Health, and he's also Chair of ARCH as well. And I also have Dr. Faisal Dubash, who many of you may have met before or also listened to previous podcasts. And today we're going to be concentrating on homelessness and maybe some signposting and what can be offered within the health service. So welcome both. Welcome both to this podcast. Firstly, I will go on to Faisal because I know you're short of time today, Faisal. Faisal, can you just introduce and talk about a little bit of what we are hoping to achieve from this podcast today?
Thanks, Tina. And so I'm Faisal, a consultant dermatologist at NHS Tayside, and I'm fortunate to be a member of the Global Health British Association of Dermatologists Working Party Group. And we've developed a particular focus on how we as dermatologists can get involved and do our bit to help with inclusion health. And we've got a special person with us today, Christopher Sargent, who we're really, really delighted to have on this podcast. And he's got numerous years experience in the field. Over to you, Chris. We'd love to hear from you regarding the work that you do, the initiatives you're involved in, and perhaps we can end on what the future holds for inclusion health in Britain.
Sure. Thank you very much. And thank you for having me on the podcast. It's a great pleasure to be here. So perhaps what I'll start with is a little bit about what I've done in my career. And then go on to what I think might be helpful for people to do, perhaps in their day-to-day work, in terms of the places that people can help with inclusion health, which I think will come out of some of the things that I say. So my background is clinical background is as a GP. I started working in inclusion health back in the last millennium, 1998, when I helped to set up a new surgery in the centre of Brighton for people experiencing homelessness. At the time, there were three people there. There was myself, a nurse practitioner called Norma House, and Karen French, who was the administrator. And we had a list of zero. We had two consulting rooms and a reception, and we opened the doors and let it be known around the place that people experiencing homelessness were welcome to come and register with us. Fast forward all those 27 years, and now that place is called ARCH, which stands for Accessible Restorative Community Health. It's still a surgery which specializes in helping people experiencing homelessness, but now has about 25 people there. It has five doctors, I think. I haven't forgotten anybody. Five nurses. We have in reach from other services. We have a physio who comes there. We have a team of receptionists and a manager. The service does not only doing the services that we started with, which is like a GP surgery, was particularly accessible, but does outreach services. So we'll go and find people who are sleeping out on the street or people are in day centres or in emergency or temporary accommodation. It has an in-reach team, which I've also worked in, which goes into the local hospital to try and find people experiencing homelessness in hospital and help to plan for their discharge. We have people who go to local day centres. We have a health engagement team, which is linked to us, of people who will help people get to their appointments and make sure that they make the best of the opportunities that they've got. So it's grown into a whole new service from those sort of small beginnings. We also And I know you're going to have another podcast with some of the Pathway Lived Experience group. We also have a lived experience arm called Common Ambition, who over the last few years have again grown to be the sort of local go-to service for all sorts of different services. So council services, housing, mental health services, all to go to them for advice about how to better organise their services so that people experiencing homelessness can use them better, so they're more user-friendly. And then Pathway, I became involved with Pathway about 12, 14 years ago. Pathway is a national charity which is interested in seeing the health and health outcomes of people experiencing homelessness and the other inclusion health groups. So people who are working in selling sex workers, people who have migrated to the country, so people who are here and don't have good access to services, and people from the Gypsy Roma traveller populations. All those people are people that we're interested in seeing them have better health outcomes, because they're the groups that really have the worst outcomes in society. We know that people in the inclusion health groups have standardised mortality ratios, so death rates of about 10 times the general population, and 5 or 6 times that of even people in the worst types of housing. We know that people experiencing homelessness, particularly rough sleepers, die young. They die in their 40s, whereas the rest of us can expect to live into our 80s or pushing up to the 90s now. So really poor overall health outcomes. And within that, there's the if you look at any condition or disease, then those conditions are going to be much, much more common and much more serious in the inclusion health groups than they are in the likes of us who have somewhere stable to live. Some of that comes from the way that we organise our services. So services, I think, are designed and organised and administered by, you know, people who do have somewhere stable to live, who have good literacy skills, who have a smartphone so they can use the online systems. A lot of people in the inclusion health groups, including homelessness, don't have any of those things. They have lots of things that they have to do in their day. They don't have a kind of good way of remembering all the things they have to do in 3 weeks' time, like you and I would do from our phones and our diaries. So the systems that we have don't serve our populations very well. And so people will be sent an email or a letter, perhaps in the old days or perhaps still, which they won't receive because they haven't got an address for that letter to go to. If it gets to the address, it's probably a shared address where everyone's looking at everybody's post. Or the person will get the letter to their old address, but they'll have moved on to a new address. And then they turn into somebody who, you know, doesn't want their appointment or doesn't turn up for their appointment. So I think there's a lot we could do in the way we organise our services to improve that. I think one of the things that clinicians can do is have a bit of curiosity about why people don't come to their appointments. So hospital policies are often that if you miss your appointment, you get taken off the waiting list because everyone's very keen to get the waiting list down. And you don't get sent another appointment. And if you contact, you're told to go back to your GP and start the process all over again. And I think a little bit of curiosity for some people about why they haven't kept their appointment, and perhaps having some flexibility around those rules. If you see that the person who's been referred to you either has got no fixed abode or looks to be in temporary accommodation or has been referred by one of the surgeries that you know register lots of people experiencing homelessness, then, you know, to give a second chance or even to pick up the phone and ring the surgery and say, this person hasn't come, but I see that they've got a serious problem that you want our help with. Is there anything we can do? Is there anybody that we can contact to send that address to, send that appointment to, or a different address? Although people experiencing homelessness, people in the other inclusion health groups often are quite isolated. They do have places that they go and they do have people that work with them. So, you know, our outreach team will often know where a person is going to be. People tend to be creatures of habit. They'll be going to particular day centres. They'll be going to particular sites to sleep. So calling a surgery like ours, you know, you're likely to get very good information about where you can find that person and the best person to contact. They may have somebody who's working with them, a key worker or an outreach worker who knows them well and sees them regularly, and getting that person on board and getting that person to be able to come to an appointment with the person can reap great benefits, partly because you'll have somebody there to do your collateral history with. You'll be there, somebody there to support the person, because it's often quite difficult for people experiencing homes to come into a kind of very clinical, organised setting. It's not the environment they're used to. I always think of it as me going into a homelessness setting. I wouldn't have the skills and the ability and know how to manage myself if I was in a group of rough sleepers. I think that's the same feeling that somebody would get coming into a clinic. That, you know, it's a very different environment. The skills they have to survive and manage are not skills that will get you seen quickly and well in a clinical environment. So it's really helpful if you have a key worker who knows the person well, knows how to kind of keep them all right, keep them happy, and much more likely to get success that way. And I think when you see people, I think it's important to be friendly and open. People experiencing homelessness have a kind of radar for people talking down to them, being sort of trying to put them down. Nobody likes that. Nobody likes being talked about when they're there. But that happens a lot to our population. So treating people with respect, asking them in straight, talking to people in straightforward language. Again, sort of when I was working in the hospital, I'd often be on the other side of a curtain, not necessarily with somebody experiencing homelessness, just a normal person, a regular client. And some of the way that we doctors lapse into sort of medical jargon, medical language, just some of the words that we use all the time don't mean anything to the general population. And they can be misinterpreted as meaning something more serious than we're talking about. So anything acute, people think means, you know, they're going to die quite soon if they've got something that's acute. So using sort of regular medical language, perhaps what I would say the sort of language that I'd use to speak to my mum or dad, who are not medical at all, in terms of explaining medical things to them, that can help a lot. And just being open and straightforward, telling people what the plan is. Often in hospital, like, you know, we'd go and see people in a ward who'd been in for 3 or 4 days. They'd have no idea what was wrong with them, what the investigations were, what the plan is. So some really sort of basic things that can really help. We also know that people experiencing homelessness discharge themselves from hospital prematurely quite often. And that's one of the reasons that people say is that because I didn't know what was happening, I didn't know what's going on. It got to Friday evening, everybody gone home. Nobody told me what was happening. I thought, well, I'm not staying here. I'm going to go as well. So keeping people informed and just speaking to people as you would speak to anybody else, I think will probably get you quite a long way.
I think that's really important.
Lots of Chris. Different areas there.
Yeah, no, that's great. Fantastic. And I think you've really hit some really valuable points there, curiosity. And that is really valuable because, you know, quite often we have DNAs and that is it, you know, people are discharged, and it's critical that we explore that a wee bit more before that happening. I think that's really good. And being honest, I think there is a huge stigma around this as well. And I know speaking to homeless when I do my consultations clinicianly, you know, the stigma of even being in the waiting room can be quite traumatic if people are moving away or they feel that they, you know, the odour can be really quite difficult. So you must face an awful lot of challenges, Chris, is that correct?
Certainly the yeah, the patients face a lot of challenges. I mean, in terms of organising services, I am a firm believer that people in all the inclusion health groups need to know that the place they're going to is for them, because they're very used to going to places and being told, oh, no, this isn't the right place for you. You should be somewhere else. You should be at the clinic down the road. Oh, you can only come here on a Tuesday at 3:30 or whatever it might be. So making sure that people know the services for them and that it's suitable for them and open to them. And I think that leads on to thinking about how services are sort of made available to people. So obviously with a specialist service like Arch, over the last 25 years, people have come to know that that's the place you can go. People tell each other, everybody who works in the local services, the day centres and things are all know where people can go now. But that takes time to build up. I think having something up on the wall that says, you know, everyone's welcome here, people experiencing homelessness are welcome to come and register at this surgery is good. But the real sort of acid test is when a person goes to register, can they actually register at that surgery? Can they get past the receptionist? Can they get into the clinic, into the outpatients? And that's often where things fall down. So you can have all the policies and everything you want to say it's okay, but if somebody goes in and then is sent away, they're not likely to come back to that place again, but they may not come back anywhere again for quite a long time, because to the person approaching the service, that is the system. We are the NHS, and if the NHS has told them they can't go there, then they won't go back to the NHS again, or they may not go back until they're really, really sick. And of course, then that presents a problem for everybody, because people are only presenting when they don't have any choice, because they're so ill that they've got to then. And then it's an emergency admission and, you know, lots of expense and all of that, which could have been avoided by having better availability of services, you know, at the other end of the journey.
Absolutely. And I think that's an important point about the, you know, having something up on the clinic walls as well. Faisal, over to you. You were going to ask a question.
Yes, I think you covered some really good points, Chris. One of them was just, you mentioned throughout all these steps in the pathway for people experiencing homelessness, really this, do you find that, you know, from a communication level, that first consultation between the doctor and the patient, I mean, have you had cases where or have you heard of cases of where patients have just lost complete trust in the clinician? Maybe they were talked down to, weren't acknowledged as a person in front of the doctor, and maybe they may have been so disheartened they wouldn't come back, as you say, and that's the risk, isn't it, of if we don't approach them in the right, correct, sensitive way, is that?
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah. I think, and that leads on to the point that a lot of people from inclusion health groups have experienced some sort of trauma in their lives, often as children. So there's already a level of distrust of authority. And although we try not to be authoritarian as doctors these days, we're still seen as authority figures. And that can sort of make people more reluctant to go to see a doctor or a nurse. And then if something goes wrong at the beginning of that consultation, then all their fears are, you know, confirmed. And then, oh, I told you so. I told you there was no point coming here. I told you they wouldn't listen to me. And then, as you say, that person's out the door and they won't be coming back anytime soon. So remembering trauma and trauma-informed care. So, you know, approach, and we're all busy and we have to get through our people who are on our list of people to be seen. But just taking a little bit of extra time to introduce yourself, you know, establish some rapport, have a chat about things, maybe just congratulate people on getting to the clinic, because it's not an easy thing for people to do. So, you know, well done for coming to see me. I'm glad you've come to see me about this issue. There's things that we can do to help. You know, all of that really, really helps to reassure them that you're on their side and that you know, that there is going to be a positive, it is going to be a positive interaction between the two people involved. And I think some of it is getting it down to it just being two people talking about something. So it's one person who's got a lot of expertise in the clinical side, and one person who's got a lot of expertise in what it's like to, you know, to be experiencing homelessness. And you've got to sort of bring those two people together with both their areas of expertise, and then have a kind of negotiation about what's the best way to go about addressing this problem. Because some of our usual ways of doing things aren't going to work for this population. So if it's, you know, going somewhere every day to have something done for an hour, or going somewhere every day waiting 2 hours for something to be done for an hour, that's not going to happen. It's a plan that's not going to work, and there needs to be some flexibility on both sides in order to make that work. So a lot of our appointments at Arch will be on the day appointments, so people can either walk in at a particular time or ring in at a particular time and get, so about half of our appointments are on the day, because we know that people, when there's a problem, we need to be able to see them when they're ready to be seen at the moment they want to be seen. You also need some time to follow people up, and you want to be trying to help people to get into a more kind of regular way of using services. So we also have half of our appointments sort of pre-bookable, so that people can plan their lives as well, because, you know, everyone has things to do, and people experiencing homelessness also have lots of things that they need to do in order to try and improve their situation.
Yeah, I mean, you've definitely discussed some main points there, and, you know, key aspects to you know, being homeless and having accessible to, you know, healthcare. I think key issues there to bring out is that the rapport and the relationship has to be built very quickly. And I think you mentioned there about the mistrust sometimes, and it's really important to have that trust and respect between the two people. I think that's really important, and to treat everyone on the same, you know, whoever you are, whatever circumstances you are, is so important, and not to have that kind of hierarchy sort of, you know, persona. So I think communication, I think, you know, the relationship, the rapport, compassion, all should be built into this, but also the fact that accessible and flexibility is really important as well. So I'm going to ask the question for myself, and being a clinician in the hospital, and I have come across people that are homeless or maybe been in prison, and it does add a lot of complications. And you've mentioned obviously the services that you are involved in. How, as a clinician, can I signpost or help people that are in this situation, because we don't have a walk-in service where I'm based?
Yeah. So I think for people in hospital, there's quite a lot that you can do if you've got somebody who's homeless on the ward. So the first thing is to make sure that you've done what's called the duty to refer, which is a legal duty on public institutions, including hospitals, to tell the local authority housing people that you have somebody experiencing homelessness in your service. So you can do that by sending an email to the housing department, and the email address is usually duty2refer@whatever the council name is.gov.uk, and that will be on your local council website. So it'd be well worth people finding out how to do that. All they need is you need to get the person's permission first. They give you their permission for you to do it, is to send an email to the council saying what the person's name is, what their date of birth is. National insurance number is really helpful if they know that. Most people know their national insurance number and where they are, so which ward they're on, and how to contact them. A mobile number is really useful, so because then the people from the council can ring the person directly. If not, the ward telephone number is also really useful, because they can contact through there. And once you've done that, the thing to do is to do that as soon as possible. So when I was working in the pathway teams in the hospital, we try and do that as soon as we knew about the person. We do that day one, because the council need time to do their investigations. And if all goes according to plan, then they will then be able to find somewhere for the person to be discharged to once their admission comes to an end. That's one thing you can do. If it's somebody who's going to be sleeping out that night, then you can refer onto a website, which I will need to get you the address of. I can't remember it offhand.
We can link that in, don't worry, Chris.
Yeah, sure. So you can send the same sort of details and a description of the person and where they are sleeping rough or where they're going to be sleeping rough. And then the next outreach service in that locality will go and find them. So that's two things that can really help to make a difference to the person. I think making links between services and so clinical services and housing services is really useful. And I think anybody working in a kind of discharge team or anything like that will be well served to make links, even when you haven't got a patient to talk about, just about to talk about how you work together and how you can improve those links. Then in terms of sort of local services, they're different in different places. So not everywhere will have a specialist service that can be, that person can be referred to, like Arch in Brighton. But everybody's entitled to register with a GP. So finding out in your local sort of health administration how to get somebody registered with a GP, or ringing around a few surgeries and seeing who might be happy to take, who might be happy to register somebody. We get people registered while they're in the hospital, which is difficult to do, but it's some places you can do it because it's an online registration system. So that's something that's really helpful as well, sort of having information that you can give people. The other thing is to be in contact with local day centres and any outreach services. So every area will have a rough sleeper outreach team. Lots of areas, most areas will have some sort of day centre, and finding those locally and being able to signpost people there would be really useful, because then even if you can't help them, the people in the day centre will know the system and know how to sort of plug people into services. In the olden days, you could advise people to just go to the housing department and be asked to be seen. You could present as homeless to the council sort of there and then. But since COVID, a lot of councils have taken away that sort of open door policy. So now everyone has to apply. It's usually a kind of online application. But yeah, so I think the answer there is to find out about your local services. And sort of try and make some links with them, so that they're there when you need them. And also it means that they would know who to contact, a contact in the hospital, because again, those of us who worked in hospitals, they seem like, very functional, open places where everybody can get what they want. But if you're approaching a hospital from the outside, it can be really difficult to find who is the person to speak to or get to the right person at the right time. So the more links there are between hospitals and community and housing, the better it is for everybody.
That's great, and that's really useful information. I feel myself, before I became involved in these projects, I was a bit, I would say, totally clueless of what can provided, which made me sort of reflect on the fact that I have experienced this within my consultations. But I think it's really good to source out what you can signpost, and help individuals as well, and not just dismiss at the end of the 20 minutes, 30 minutes consultation. So I feel, to our listeners today, it's really important to find out what is available there. And so thank you for that. You mentioned about key workers, and I think that's another important aspect. Do key workers kind of help when it comes to like things like mental health or with people that experience homelessness?
It all depends. So there's different sorts of key workers and different sorts of support workers. So most people who are in supported accommodation, what we would call a hostel, would have a key worker in the hostel, is somebody who's responsible for looking after that particular person, trying to help them make progress. Then there may be outreach workers. So they may be general outreach workers, or they may be mental health outreach workers. And there's sort of trials going on at the moment about having nurses in outreach teams as well to try and improve their sort of clinical clinical input to those teams there. Then people may have if they're under a mental health team, they may have a mental health e-worker or a mental health outreach worker as well. Anybody going to a day centre, again, if they've been going there for a while, is likely to have a support worker or a key worker who's been, again, sort of specially assigned to try and help them. So it's different in different situations. But most people who are in touch with services will have somebody who's involved in their care and trying to help move them on. So they are usually delighted if they're rung by somebody from the hospital, because it doesn't happen very often, to say, we've seen this person. And if you have to get consent to share information, but if they've given consent to share, then you can share the plan with them, and they can be really helpful in helping everybody get what they want out of the situation.
Fabulous.
I've looked it up actually. It's StreetLink is the name of the website where you can refer people who are sleeping rough. So there's a website which is thestreetlink.org.uk. And then there's a map there where you can pinpoint on the map where the person's going to be, and then the outreach service will go and see them.
Wow, that's really impressive and something I'd just never heard of. So that's really, really useful. Thank you very much for that. And I know now, having written articles and sort of delving a wee bit more into homelessness, the increase, and also in areas that you may not have thought of that were experienced homelessness are actually experiencing this. Do you find, Chris, that numbers are increasing all the time, or is this something, you know, that we should seriously be sort of looking at?
Yeah, so we know that numbers are going up now. So there have been phases where numbers of people sleeping rough and the other types of homelessness, because obviously it's not just people rough sleeping, it's people living in unsuitable accommodation, people threatened with being threatened with eviction, people living in sort of emergency accommodation, people who are staying with friends is a big group. So what people call sofa surfers, so staying in an arrangement which can end at any moment because you're on there out of the goodness of somebody else's heart, or there's other arrangements where people maybe are swapping something for accommodation. So some people sort of trade sex for accommodation. And those are obviously very insecure arrangements which can end at any time. So all those people fall under the umbrella of homelessness. So we know that homelessness is going up. We know that the numbers of people in emergency and temporary accommodation are going up. We know there's a large number of children and families in emergency accommodation, often in accommodation that they shouldn't really be in, sort of shared with other people. So the problem is getting worse at the moment. There have been good phases, I think, where there's a lot of investment and focus from government put into homelessness. The numbers do come down quite rapidly. So I think 10 years after we started our surgery down in Brighton, numbers actually got down to quite a low level, but have increased, unfortunately, since then. During COVID, numbers went down to very, very low levels because special accommodation was opened up that people could go into. But unfortunately, as soon as COVID was over, a lot of those were closed down again. And so the numbers have been increasing since then. And it's also a kind of barometer of what's happening economically for people. So cost of living going up means cost of rents going up as well, means that people, you know, people can't afford the accommodation they're in. So that can mean that they aren't able to pay their rent. So that means that they become evicted and they become homeless that way. Or people are in these sort of unstable situations and something goes wrong and then they become homeless. So, yeah, we do know that the numbers are going up. But we also know that the sort of criteria and the level that you have to hit to get help from different services is going up all the time as well. So particularly, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, some of our patients would have been judged as having care needs and be accommodated by adult social care. So because, again, because there's been a squeeze on resources there, those thresholds have gone up to a much higher level. So a lot of those people will now be told that they don't meet the threshold for adult social care help. And if nothing else can be found for them, then some of those people perhaps go into emergency accommodation, which is not suitable for time, and then can't manage there, and then become homeless because they can't manage, or they're evicted or whatever it is. So if you can't manage and you mess up your room, you'll be evicted. So that can be a way in which people sort of repeatedly become homeless as well.
So many challenges out there, isn't there? And yeah, it's quite something. And also I feel that, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, I might not be having these conversations with people in my, you know, patients in my consultations. But these days, you're quite often talking about the aspects that you've talked about, you know, and the cost of living and, you know, people not being able to afford. And it's even difficult even getting into a lot of hospitals, you know, with the cost, and many are in city centres, and, you know, all these aspects of actually the challenges that people are faced with even getting into hospitals is really, really tricky. But I think this is, you know, is talking about these aspects and, you know, trying to sort of spread the word and what is available is really, really important. And, you know, I can't thank you enough for coming on this podcast today as well to talk about this and the amazing work that you have done. And, you know, being 27 years doing this as well is phenomenal. Could you just recap, Chris, because we are coming out of short of time with the podcast, but can you just recap on the key aspects you would say as a clinician being able to signpost on what is available out there and how we can actually help our patients?
Yeah. Sure. Before I do that, I should say that I'm also Secretary of the Faculty of Homeless and Inclusion Health, which is a membership organisation which is free to join. So if people are interested in this sort of thing, they should join the faculty. We do ask for a donation for people to join, but there's no sort of membership fee. And we also have subgroups. So we've got an education group, we've got a student group, a primary care group, a nurses group. So there's various different ones that people can join if they want to. So, yeah, I think in terms of signposting, I think the important things are to know what you need to do yourself. So those are things like the legal duty to refer to the local council. And you can also refer people who are rough sleeping to StreetLink, which was the one that I couldn't remember the name of before, through the StreetLink website. And that allows you to pinpoint where a rough sleeper is going to be or where they are. So an outreach team will come and see them on their next outreach session. To know what your local services are and to sort of make contact with local services is really useful. So that's both clinical services. So if there is a particular surgery which will register people experiencing homelessness, but also things like day centres and outreach services. So rough sleepers outreach services are usually organised by the local authority. If there's any other outreach services that go out, there's often things like soup runs, run by local charities, really useful to have contacts in those particularly if you're trying to find somebody that you've seen who hasn't come for an appointment. I think be curious about people who don't turn up for their appointments. There's good evidence that missing appointments is a really bad prognostic sign for people, and it's a sign that people are not doing well. And they may be the ones that you really need to see are the ones that haven't come to see you. So, putting a little bit of extra effort into that. And if you do have contacts for people, using those contacts. So they may not have responded to the letter, but you might have a mobile number. You might have the name of the day centre, the name of the surgery. And then using, in the same way, using the other people who are in contact with the person you're trying to see. So it may be a key worker or a support worker. They can be really, really useful people for support and information and making sure that you get the outcome that everybody wants, which is for the person to get better and not have to use your service in the future.
Thank you so much, Chris, for all that really valuable information. And in regards to Pathway as well, we have got another podcast that has been allocated for actually to speak to one of the nurses that's heavily involved in Pathway, and also the lived experience as well. We have got another podcast for that as well. So, there's so much we can talk about, isn't there? So we are trying to run a whole series of podcasts and interview journals, articles on this topic. And also, if anyone does want to get in touch for any more information, you can reach out to the BDNG, and obviously I can get in touch with the various people that are involved. So I'd like to say a massive thank you, Chris. I could really speak to you all day. It is, a really valuable topic we're talking about, and something, that we can all help with. And like you say, be curious about as well, and build up that rapport and try and sort of limitate the stigma that's involved with homelessness as well. So thanks very much, Chris, for coming onto this podcast today. Thank you very much. Thank you. We will, just to say to our listeners as well, we will be putting all the links that have been allocated to us from Pathway and other valuable sources as well. So we will be putting that into our e-newsletters and also onto the back of some of the podcasts as well. So thank you. Thanks again, Chris.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. For further information on the BDNG, visit our website bdng.org.uk and watch out for the next BDNG podcast, which is coming soon.